From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We've all been there, in the local supermarket, faced with a mind-boggling array of choices. 100 kinds of cookies, an endless aisle of juice, yards of toothpaste. Our guest tonight, psychologist Barry Schwartz, has been there and counted. But in spite of their wealth of options today on many fronts, he says American consumers are not necessarily happier. Too much choice may even be making them miserable. Today, Americans choose from thousands of options, everything from their Friday night DVD to the right college to investment alternatives for their 401k. So is this freedom or a new tyranny of choice? Tonight on Point, inside the endless options of America, dissecting the psychology of consumer choice. When you go shopping, do you feel liberation or a burden of choice? Is there such a thing as too much choice? And are we there yet? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Philadelphia is Barry Schwartz, professor of psychology at Swarthmore College and author of the new book, The Paradox of Choice, Why More is Less. Good evening and welcome, Barry Schwartz.
Hi, Tom. Thanks very much for having me on.
Thanks for joining us. So what's the problem, Barry? We all sort of have been raised to believe that the land of milk and honey, of endless choice, was the idea. But you're finding it's not necessarily so.
That's correct. Your lead-in was actually a perfect summary of the idea. We have been raised to believe correctly that you can't be fully human unless you have significant choice in most areas of life. It's part of what it means to be a person is that you get to determine how your life's going to go. And we've made the not unreasonable assumption that if choice is essential, if some choice is good, that it must be true that more choice is better. How could it not be true? If you don't care about choosing among 200 cereals, you can ignore 198 and just alternate between the two that you're used to eating. Somebody's made better off. You're not made worse off. What's the harm? It's very compelling logically, but what we've been finding is that psychologically, there can be too much choice. Some choice is good, but more choice is not better.
It seems almost criminal at some level to even be in this conversation when we know how many billions of people on the planet do not face those fully stocked supermarket shelves. And even millions of Americans are out there who cannot afford to shop for anything like that full range of choice. And yet you see a lot of people who are grappling with it. As a psychologist, what's the downside? What's the evidence that this is a problem for people? What do you see happening?
Well, there are several different things that happen. Let me begin by making a distinction that my colleagues and I have made between people who aim to get something that's good enough when they make a choice. We call them satisficers. Good enough cereal, good enough toothpaste, good enough car, good enough job, good enough place to live,
okay,
good enough 401k, and people who aspire to the best. These people we call maximizers. And what we find is that if you're a maximizer, if you're out to get the best, the only way you can know that you've gotten the best is if you examine all of the possibilities.
Which is a big chore these days.
It's not a big chore. It's an impossible chore, as you so vividly demonstrated. You'd spend your life examining all the toothpaste possibilities. So it's just not possible. So what happens if you're out to get the best and you can't actually determine what the best is? You eventually make a choice. And then you're plagued with doubt that what you chose actually was the best, plagued with regret that if you'd spent a little more time looking or started looking in a different place, you'd have done better. You also develop these extraordinarily high expectations about how good the results of your choice are going to turn out to be, given that you had so many options.
You've invested so much time.
You really ought to find something that's perfect. And you know what we've learned over the years in psychology is that how good something feels to people has to do with how it stacks up against their expectations. So if you have modest expectations, you may end up choosing something that's delightful. If you have very high expectations, you're almost certain to be disappointed, no matter how good the thing you choose is objectively.
All right. Have you analyzed the population then? Do you have an idea what portion of American consumers are satisficers, as you call them, people for whom good enough is good enough, and what portion are maximizers? I mean, is it
a
minority who are plagued with this, or is it widespread?
We don't really know that because the measuring instrument we use is just a kind of continuous scale, and the higher you score on it, the more maximizer like you are, so it would be arbitrary to put a dividing line between people who are maximizers and people who aren't. So what we generally find is the higher you score as a maximizer, the less optimistic you are, the less happy you are, the less satisfied you are with the choices you make, the longer it takes you to make choices, the more you look over your shoulder at what other people are doing, and the closer you are to scoring as clinically depressed. Extreme maximizers are borderline clinically depressed.
Now, talk about a paradox. I don't even know if that's the right word, but you're saying that the people who most vigorously engage with this huge spectrum of choice that the American economy offers today are also most likely to be even clinically depressed?
That's what we're finding. And it is a paradox because some of the best theories of depression out there focus on how it is the absence of control over life that triggers clinical depression. And you'd think that the hallmark of being in control is being able to have choices. So if you want to prevent depression, you just give people as much choice as possible. And we've done that, and what we're experiencing is an epidemic of depression. Depression isn't polio. It hasn't gone away. It's three times more likely that people will be depressed now than 25 years ago.
So how do you explain that, that such a superabundance of choice actually circles back around to lead to depression?
Well, one thing is, as I said a moment ago, if your expectations are exceedingly high and you choose, you know, you have extremely high hopes for the college you choose. You invest an enormous amount of time and effort into choosing the college. You get into the one you chose and you think life is going to be perfect. Mm. Well, you know, it turns out life isn't perfect. What a shock. But because your expectations were so high, the imperfections become unbearable. If you, you know, had more modest expectations about how college was going to change your life, the same objective experience you'd interpret as positive rather than negative, so as exhilarating rather than disappointing. That's one thing. One other thing is this. When there are all these options and you choose something that's disappointing, you ask yourself, we all do, whose fault is it that the choice I made didn't live up to my hopes?
What an idiot I am.
Well, exactly. When there are two choices, when there are two options and you choose something and it's not very good, it's the world's fault. It's not yours. When there are thousands of options and you choose something that's not very good, that's disappointing, you can't help but think that you're responsible. So people blame themselves whenever they make decisions that end up being less good than they'd hoped.
So you
see, this is why I think you get this increase in depression.
And why you say maybe more is less. You seem to be pointing at some kind of metaphysical illusion here. It has to do with quantity, as though there's some kind of maybe even measurable quantity of choice at which the human mind or some human personalities begin to sort of collapse under the weight of choosing.
I think that's right, and I can't begin to say what the magic number is, but as a colleague pointed out to me, for almost our entire history as a species, the kinds of choices we've had to make were of the following kind. Is this going to eat me or should I eat it? Is this a good thing or a bad thing? Should I run toward it or run away from it? All of a sudden now, in the last, 100 years, we're faced not with that kind of choice, but rather, which of these two incredibly attractive, or 10 or 20 or 100 incredibly attractive things should I choose? Why can't I have all of them? It's a mystery, and I don't think we're equipped to make these kinds of nuanced distinctions among extremely attractive alternatives, and it really creates stress, anxiety, postponement of decisions, and it makes people miserable. And this is not the kind of choice that people were built to make.
Barry Schwartz, what's the range of sorts of choices that confront people with this dilemma, this paradox? Is it just about physical things, material things, toothpaste, cookies, I don't know, pistol grips, or is it also about less tangible items?
If it were only about the tangible things, then however miserable these choices made people, I don't think it would be a sort of a social calamity. But we are also faced with real choices about every aspect of life. People, the students I teach, are faced with deciding what kind of work to do. Should I try to make money? Should I do something that's socially valuable? Should I go to work in an exciting city? Should I go to work where my partner is? Anything is possible. And there's some right answer to that question. And what happens is they get paralyzed. People have to decide what to study in college from hundreds and hundreds of possibilities that colleges make available, mistakenly thinking that they're doing students a favor by essentially giving them a complete smorgasbord instead of something structured. People have to decide what kind of medical treatment to get. Doctors will no longer tell patients what to do. They lay out the options and they expect the autonomous patient, almost completely ignorant, of course, to be the one who makes the decision. What a burden that is on people. People don't want this responsibility, but the sort of standards of medical ethics nowadays are that people, it's your responsibility, not mine. All I can do is tell you what's possible. People can now decide what they look like physically. This incredible growth industry in plastic surgery and Botox allows each of us to, I mean, if you got the money, to take pieces of your body that you don't like away, add to other pieces of your body that you don't like. I mean, everything is up for grabs. You can sculpt whatever appearance you like, which means that what you look like has become a matter of choice. It's not something you have to live with.
Wow.
People get to choose what religion to practice and in what way. There's every imaginable variety of religious observance available to people, at least in urban areas. People get to decide whether they're going to marry, whether they're going to marry early or late, whether they're going to have children, whether they're going to have children early or late. Every one of these monumental decisions is a real matter of choice.
So you've got some great cartoons that you've brought into the book. I'm looking at one here where two parents are sitting talking to a young child, looks maybe 10 years old, saying, "We're thinking maybe it's time you started getting some religious instruction. There's Catholic, Protestant, and Jewish. Any of those sound good to you?" And the child is supposed to choose.
Exactly. But, and you know what? The reason that that particular cartoon is in the book is that, as a young, enlightened parent, I kind of had that view.
Right.
This is, you know, the way to be a responsible parent is you put all of the options out there and you let your somehow wise enough children make decisions. And I think parents think, at least, you know, the sort of highly educated upper middle class parents think, this is the model of enlightened parenting. And what I actually think it is a recipe for disaster. I think it tortures children. It puts them in a position where they're not possibly able to cope with, and it's all in the service of being liberal and enlightened.
So limit the choices. There's another cartoon very late in the book where you see two chickens who have made their way somehow to what looks like the North Pole, the South Pole, I don't know, and they're saying one to the other, "They never should have allowed us to be free range."
Yes.
But what's the moral of this story? I mean, if we all lived in old, Soviet Union, where the economy was lousy and the government was oppressive, there were very few choices. Life in your terms here, would be easy, but those were pretty depressed societies too. Is it all about some golden mean?
I think the answer is yes, it is all about some golden mean, and I don't know what that is. I think it was George Orwell who said that you never know what is enough until you experience too much. And he wasn't talking about choice, but I think it's a particularly apt sentiment, and that's exactly what my book is trying to capture. Who would ever have thought that you could have too many choices?
I'm not sure that our society, our economy is cut out to put a limit on this. Do we have to wait for some kind of natural, economic collapse or social revolution to create these things? Is there any self-governing mechanism in this economy, this culture?
You could hope that it would be self-governing in the sense that some clever producer will start marketing products that where the whole line is simplified and streamlined in the service of peace of mind.
Isn't that what little boutiques are already in the retail sphere?
Well, yes, that's exactly what little boutiques are, and people who can afford to pay the premium now shop in little boutiques because they can't bear going to Walmart, leaving aside the politics of Walmart, and they can't bear buying their hardware at Home Depot. So
peace of mind from not having to go into a superstore, having someone else do a pre-selection, and you've got Boom Restoration Hardware or whatever it is.
Yeah, but you pay a premium for that, and not everyone is in a position to pay that premium. But the truth is, I don't think the reason that this book is focused on individuals is that I think we're not at the moment geared up as a society to engineer a dramatic shift in this worship of choice that we currently live with.
Barry Schwartz, stand by. We're talking tonight with psychologist Barry Schwartz, author of The Paradox of Choice, Why More is Less. You can join the conversation when you hit the mall, the supermarket, the TV remote. Are you overwhelmed with choices? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about how a superabundance of choices is both a blessing and a curse in contemporary America. My guest tonight is Barry Schwartz. He is professor of psychology at Swarthmore College and author of The Paradox of Choice, Why More is Less. You can join our conversation tonight. What do you think is the volume of choices Americans face, liberating or oppressive? And do you love the choosing, or do you wish you had someone to choose it all for you? What stumps you? The choices of breakfast cereal, toothpaste, college, online dates, 401k plans, coffins, you name it. It's all out there in abundance. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Luan is calling from Boston. Hi, Luan. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
I just wanted to comment that, yes, having too much choice can be very distressing. From the simplest thing as to what to eat for lunch all the way to careers, as you guys mentioned earlier. But I wonder if maybe it's simply a matter of people taking things too seriously, and maybe it's just the culture that makes what we decide such a powerful component of our happiness.
Of our happiness, of our self-identity. Let me ask you, Luan. Barry Schwartz was describing people he called satisficers, people for whom good enough is good enough. I'm not going to spend forever making this choice. And others, he calls them maximizers, you know, who want to be sure they've made the right choice. Which are you?
I would consider myself a maximizer to the extent that my means allow me to be.
So does it make you miserable? Are you taking it too seriously?
Sometimes, yes. I think I do. And I think that's a problem that a lot of, not just Americans, but for the purpose of this conversation, Americans have.
Yeah. Luan, thanks for your call. Barry Schwartz, how about it? Luan says maybe we're just taking it too seriously, but how do you avoid that?
I think that you don't avoid it except by practice. I have some suggestions in the book about what people can do if the story I tell rings true and they do find themselves kind of overwhelmed. But none of these suggestions is a magic pill. Teach yourself to be satisfied with good enough. Well, it's easy to say that. It's not so easy to do that. And in the short run, when you decide to start settling for good enough, you'll be nagged every time you settle for good enough that if you'd looked a little harder, you'd have found something better. Decide when to choose and when not to, when to let someone else choose for you. Choose when to choose is how I put it.
And you also say don't be plagued by the range of choices that someone else may be selecting from. Don't judge yourself against others all the time.
That's right. Now, it's kind of interesting. For some reason, you know, we all compare ourselves to other people, but it seems as though we're kind of biased, so that mostly what we're looking for is evidence from other people who are doing better than we are. So if we're disappointed, that's when we start looking around for evidence. When we're pleased, we don't look around so much to see that we've done better than other people. So most of the time when we do social comparisons, they make us feel worse, not better. And the trouble is that if you're a maximizer, you almost can't avoid doing social comparisons because you can't possibly examine all the alternatives. So you're desperately trying to get information about what car to buy or what stereo to buy or what to invest in. So you're looking at what other people are doing. And every time you discover someone who's done better than you, it's like a kick in the stomach.
Another great cartoon in here. It's in an office scene. The employee's leaning over the desk talking to his boss and saying, okay, if you can't see your way to giving me a pay raise, how about giving Parkerson a pay cut? He would feel better if the other guy was at least doing worse.
Sadly, that cartoon captures a very fundamental aspect of our character.
Oh, boy, there we are. Joan is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Joan, you're on the air.
Hi. This is very refreshing. I thought it was only me.
No, there's a lot of people in that boat, you maximizer, you.
Oh, my gosh. I have a hard time. Just recently, I was in the grocery store, and the woman asked me paper or plastic, and I froze. I was like, what's the right answer?
Consumer in the headlights, quick.
Oh, my gosh. Well, the funniest thing is the answer was plastic because I have a dog, and I can use it to pick up poop with.
Right, but have you noticed the number of people now who say both?
Yeah.
I don't know if there's a rationale for that or it's just easier than deciding.
It's just crazy. And
Joan, are you there?
Way too many choices, I think. Is it the breakup of the phone company? I mean, that was the beginning of it. It seems.
I was certainly one of them.
Suddenly, from cell phones to everything else. But here's another consumer. Joan, your line's a little rough. I'm going to have to let you go, but thanks for calling. Barry, here's another consumer who's feeling it. A question sort of every minute. I wonder, at some level, what your analysis here sounds kind of like trippy psychology, but at the same time, people feel it viscerally, understand it, but also goes to the kind of heart of the American ideal as it's often been defined. I mean, how do you maintain our political system, our kind of economic ideals, and address this? Because aren't they all bound up together?
Well, I think that they aren't necessarily bound up together, though as an empirical fact, they've been bound up together in recent history. But I don't think that's necessary. Let me first say that as I've talked about this stuff in the last several weeks and also after the book's come out, I can't tell you how many comments I've gotten, unsolicited comments from people, very much like, was it Jones?
Yes, just
you know,
now.
Yes, I it was something that was driving me crazy, and I couldn't put my finger on it, and you put your finger on it. So I really do think that this captures something that is bothering many, 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 many people in society. Now, as to whether it's sort of inextricably bound up with our image of ourselves as a country, I don't think so. I think that what's happened is that choice, political choice, is crucial to our national identity and self-identity. But this is very different from picking cereal and picking soup. In fact, I think the burdens that picking cereal and soup place on us as consumers make it increasingly difficult for us to be active, engaged choosers in the areas of life that really matter. And
that is in personal relationships, in our political life, you're saying?
Exactly so. And, I think since the kind of revolution that Reagan ushered in when he became president, we have conflated choice and freedom as a political ideal with choice and consumption as an economic aspiration.
Okay, but wait a minute. Are you saying then that if I'm stymied in choosing my toothpaste, I'm going to be a less effective in choosing a lover or a leader?
Well, there's only a certain amount of time available in the day. And if you spend an hour choosing toothpaste, that's an hour that you're not spending thinking about who should be the Democratic nominee for president, which person you should ask out on a date, whether you should make a serious commitment to this other person.
Oh, boy, we've got real problems in aisle six, it seems like here. Tim is calling from Boston. Hi, Tim. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you doing?
Great, thanks.
I have a question related to the depression that seems to be linked to this choice, the overwhelming amount of choice that we have. Mm-hmm. And specifically, is this exclusively a middle-class phenomenon insofar that the poor aren't afforded the luxury of having so many choices, and the very rich are kind of restricted to the top of the line in all of their choices?
Well, let me just ask you first, Tim, have you seen the Barbie display at Walmart?
Fortunately, I haven't, no.
But that may be a luxury afforded even to the at least borderline poor, and there are an awful lot of choices even there.
I understand that, but in terms of, I guess I'm touching upon what your previous caller, mm-hmm. Luan, I think it was. Mm-hmm. He said that he was afforded the means of having a wider range of choices.
It's a great question. Let me put it to Barry Schwartz. Barry, how about it? Is it a middle, upper class problem here or wider?
Well, I think that what I'm talking about, and not depression generally, but the particular take on it that I've developed is probably restricted to people who have some means. But as you pointed out, Tom, you don't need that many means to be in a position where you're overwhelmed with choice. Walmart is the store for the working class. Walmart is the place where people who sort of make minimum wage do their shopping.
And you may have 70 styles of Chinese blue jeans under $30. I don't know.
Yeah. They may all be kind of mediocre in quality and in style, but that doesn't mean there are any fewer of them to choose from. So I wouldn't be surprised if all but the very bottom of the economic ladder face this problem in one form or another. And, of course, people who are operating within limited means, still faced with all of these choices, don't have the option of going to a boutique and letting someone else do the filtering for them. They have no alternative but to go to the big box stores and try to
the full frontal flood of what's out there.
At the best price they possibly can.
And on the question of clinical depression, do you talk with colleagues who actually have patients who come in and say, my God, doctor, I'm depressed. I just can't stand the number of choices at Sam's Club anymore.
Well, you know,
is it that literal? Is it that obvious?
It's really too soon to tell. The books, you know, a few weeks old, and these ideas have only been sort of percolating in the professional community for a short time. So I don't know the answer to that. I have a little bit of anecdotal evidence. I just gave a lecture today to several hundred coaches by telephone, and many of them, what they told me is that this resonates to an extraordinary degree with some of the problems that they encounter with their clients in their therapy and coaching sessions.
When you say coaches, you mean what sort of coach?
You know, well, coaching is sort of psychotherapy for people who don't have problems.
So life coaches, not basketball coaches.
I'm sorry. Yes, yes, life coaches. So you know, they've found, at least, again, it's only been a short time, but they have found that the kind of conceptual apparatus that I lay out in this book helps them to approach the aims that their clients have and helps their clients to understand themselves. So that's one piece of a suggestion that this really does resonate with what's bothering people. And I have a good friend and colleague who's a counselor, a psychological counselor at Swarthmore, where I teach. And she's told me that she's found the ideas that are in my book, she read it when it was a manuscript, extremely helpful in dealing with several of the students who come to her really quite miserable. So I think that it probably isn't true that people come in able to put their problem into exactly my words. But I think that when someone else gives them these words, this framework, a light bulb goes on, at least for many of them, and they recognize just how much this contributes to their unhappiness.
Tim, thanks for your call. Audrey's calling from Ann Arbor, Michigan. Hi, Audrey. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Great, thanks.
Thanks for letting me call.
Sure. Great to have you.
Shall I ask you my question?
Sure. Go for it.
Okay. Well, I am continually noticing that when I make a decision, then the real concern becomes, is it going to create the opportunity for me that I'm hoping for? And when it doesn't, then I have to start all over.
So you've got a kind of buyer's remorse or the phenomena that Barry Schwartz describes where you're dissatisfied because you didn't make the best choice finally?
Well, or that, like you say, if it's out of my control, and trying to focus myself into a direction that I can have that kind of control through my choices or my decisions. And
you've got to make a choice, but once you've made it, it's down the river and you can't usually pull it back.
That's right. And so I'm waiting for the next boat.
Audrey, thanks for your call. What do you think, Barry Schwartz?
You know, sometimes people make bad choices, or they make reasonable choices, but the world, you know, nothing is ever guaranteed, and the world just doesn't turn out the way they hoped it would or expected it would. And, you know, that's a problem now. It's always been a problem. And it's sad when that happens. But what I'm focusing on is situations where people make good choices. Choices that have results that people ought to be satisfied with and pleased with, and they aren't because they have been led to expect that the results of their choices will be even better or even best.
We're going to have to dig into some of your advice for how to personally deal with this, even if the economy and culture do not. But I've still got calls I want to get in. Adam's calling from Dennis, Massachusetts. Hi, Adam. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Great show. Thanks. I thought I'd share a little anecdote and then a couple of comments.
Yeah.
The anecdote was my brother-in-law came and worked with me for a couple of summers, and I remember going to Subway with him.
Where did he come from, Dennis?
He came from England, Hertfordshire, England.
I see.
So he came over, and we'd go to Subway for lunch, and he...
To a Subway sub shop, yeah.
Yeah, the Subway shop. And you, as you know, you get in line, and they say, what kind of meat, what kind of bread, what kind do you... And they lay out 40 different vegetables. You have to choose each one. And it was too much for him. So he started just saying, just go get me lunch. Here's $5. Get me lunch.
So he didn't starve to death, but he couldn't face the mountain of choices either.
He didn't like it. Didn't like it at all.
Did he think it was more choices than he saw in England, Adam?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Even for a fried egg, he'd say, I'll have a fried egg over easy, sunny side up. I don't know. Fried egg. We don't have those.
No, okay. So I want to get the rest of your thoughts. But first, Barry Schwartz, is it the case that it's not just affluence? I mean, England is Great Britain is a fairly affluent country as well. Is there something, you know, about the kind of hyper multiplication of options, choices in America that somehow keys off the American state of mind or American assumptions, American economics?
Everything I've heard from other people is that no matter where you come from, when you come to the United States and you go into your first store, it simply is overwhelming, it's mind-boggling, and it defies belief. So it's not just about affluence. There isn't any culture, I don't think, that has this obsession with choice and variety that characterizes the States, and everyone experiences culture shock.
So, Adam, what does that leave you thinking, Adam?
Well, I had a couple of thoughts. One was that I think that oftentimes this giving of choice is a matter of our putting the onus on someone else. We don't want to accept responsibility. What do you, you know, so we ask the other person to make the choice continuously, even if it's like a plumber coming to your house. Instead of diagnosing it and fixing it for you, they say, well, we could do any of these eight things, and they leave it on to you. The other thought I had was I had a friend, and he was terrified to get married because he felt he was giving up all the other women in the world if he chose one.
There's an old one.
It was like, I could have a million women, but if I choose one, then I give up a million women.
What a man.
But the choice, if you can make a choice, that's really where empowerment usually is. Once I commit to something, then I can move forward to it.
So if he lived in a little village and only had the choice of two women, would life be easier?
Not only would life be easier, he'd be happier with the choice he ended up making.
Because it was the best of a small pond.
Maybe, but I also think that when you make a choice, you've empowered yourself, and now you have real freedom once you've committed to a course of action.
Well, maybe. Adam, thanks for your call. Maybe, but Barry Schwartz, you're saying in this huge multiplicity of choices, actually having made one may feel empowering, or you may feel like, oh, my gosh, I've just thrown the world of other women away.
No, that's right. What Adam says is right. I mean, it ought to be the case that choices should empower you. You should feel good about having made them. You live with them. You take advantage of the consequences of them. You don't look back. That's not what happens. People make the choice, and, you know, Adam's vivid description is wonderful. There are a million other women I've passed up. Surely some of them are better than the one I ended up choosing.
Or toothpaste, or breakfast cereal.
Somehow the stakes are a little higher when it's women.
No offense, women. We value you highly. We are talking tonight about a superabundance of choices in contemporary America and how it is, maybe, both a blessing and a curse. My guest is Barry Schwartz, psychologist and author of The Paradox of Choice, Why More is Less. You can join our conversation. What's your strategy for cutting through the ocean of options? Are we hooked on choice? Would you really be happier without it? And is the choice equals happiness formula ultimately an illusion? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Barry Schwartz, author of the new book, The Paradox of Choice, Why More is Less. You can join the conversation. Do you feel the freedom of choice or the tyranny of choice? Are choice and freedom finally the same thing or not? And how about this? Is there a freedom that doesn't demand 1,000 options? Or is that un-American? We're at 1-800-423-8255. George is calling from Boston. Hi, George. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thanks.
Until I've heard this conversation, I didn't realize that this was such a traumatizing problem for so many people.
But so you were not afflicted by this problem, George?
No, I just have to say that I think that this conversation and that I think that a lot of the concerns that people are expressing here are really pathetic. And that, yeah, it's absurd that there are so many choices for toothpaste in the world.
But grab one and go home and be done with it.
What?
But grab one and go home and be done with it, you're saying.
Exactly. You know, the way you cut through that is you develop a value system that tells you that it's not that important what toothpaste you use.
So if, in fact, Barry Schwartz, if he says, yes, fine, but I see people who are clinically depressed because they stand paralyzed before the toothpaste rack, what do you say, George?
I say go out and try to do something really, really good with your life.
But, you know, George, I don't think that people get clinically depressed because they're trying to decide what toothpaste to buy. They get clinically depressed because they're also trying to decide what something good they should do with their life when they can do essentially anything. What wonderful person they should partner with for life when they can partner with essentially anyone. So the amount of choice people face with high-stakes decisions is just as overwhelming as with low-stakes decisions.
But, Barry, isn't George onto something when he says, hey, have a value system, folks, and this will shine a light. This will focus. I mean, it is sort of the flip side of what you're suggesting, that people are coming to this with no value, with no internal value system, so that they're not sort of equipped with a value system that might make the decision easy.
Well, that certainly would make it easier. You know, for example, I mean, this isn't the only value system that you can use, but if you were committed, say, to some particular brand of sort of religious orthodoxy, then you essentially have one decision to make, which is you're going to be a good Catholic or not, you're going to mm-hmm. be a good Jew or not, mm-hmm. and then your whole life gets laid out before you, and there aren't choices. You know, you've made one very big choice. You've embraced a particular set of values and a code of conduct, and it, I think, cuts through a lot of the crap that we're talking about.
Of course, right there, I hear, and I read in your book as well, there you run into something else. Americans reluctant to do that because orthodoxy itself, you write, if I read you correctly, has a way of making Americans feel cut off from freedom.
No, that's right. I think that there is a fundamental tension, a conflict that people feel in this country between the ideology of freedom, which is telling them, you know, I don't want to be constrained. I want to keep my options open. The ideal life is one in which options are open. And the kind of comfort and security, I mean, the things that have the biggest effect on human happiness are all things that tie our hands. Close social relationships with friends, membership in communities, membership in religious organizations, marriage. Material assets have a minimal effect on well-being. It's the social connectedness that really matters. And every one of these things binds us rather than liberating us.
Let's get one more call. Tom is calling from Stoneham, Massachusetts. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Hi, good evening.
Hi.
I think that if you look at sort of the way our minds have evolved and you look at our evolutionary ancestors, almost every decision that they had to make was a life or death decision, because life itself was a life or death proposition mm-hmm. at all times. And I think that the fact that we employ the same mechanisms to make what are now trivial decisions, it sort of confers on them a degree of importance that they don't really have.
So we may be hardwired to be stymied by the little stuff.
Well, and of course,
because it used to be big stuff when we decided. Yeah. Yeah, Tom, we've got it. And our time is short, very short. What do you say?
I think it's a very interesting possibility. Could well be right.
I want to run through some of your advice here. And there are too many points to get all of them. But you start out saying choose when to choose. In other words, don't fuss over every decision.
Right.
Be a chooser, not a picker. What does it mean?
Well, this really does get to what a couple of the callers were saying. My view is that a chooser is someone who is actively engaged in the process, asking what is it that I care about in this decision and why? And if there are no alternatives out there that meet my desires or my needs, how can I create one? It's very demanding of time, effort, and energy to be a chooser. And when we're faced with this overwhelming array of choices, we can't devote that time and effort and energy. So instead, we end up sitting back as the conveyor belt of things goes past us, and we simply pick. Mm. So it's much more passive, and you let other people sort of determine what the possibilities are.
Practice an attitude of gratitude. We hear this phrase. How does it relate to your focus?
What it relates to is that, as I said before, people tend to focus on what's disappointing in the results of decisions they make, and they minimize or ignore what was satisfying. And this is a common characteristic of human beings. So by spending some time every day, 5 minutes even, identifying two or three things that happened during the day that you're grateful for, things that are good, you can develop a habit that focuses more on the good aspects, aspects of the decisions you've made, and less on the bad ones. By and large, you know, decisions you make, you're going to be making good decisions that have good results. This
so
will
be
put
happy.
The emphasis.
Don't worry, be happy. And perhaps the big one, the last one, the challenging one for Americans: learn to love constraints.
Yes. And that was this, the point I was making about the constraints of being a close friend or being a marital partner or a member of a religious community. This we tend to regard each of these things in modern society as something to chafe at and try and break away from and prevent ourselves from being enmeshed in. And all of the evidence suggests that it is just these kinds of entanglements that actually promote our well-being. They limit our choices, but they make us much happier.
Americans learn to love constraints. Barry Schwartz, thanks very much for being with us tonight. Fascinating.
Thank you. It really was a pleasure, Tom.
Barry Schwartz, professor of psychology at Swarthmore College and author of the new book, The Paradox of Choice. Why More is Less. You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, a visit with an Army reservist who has just returned from Iraq. This is On Point. Over the next 4 to 6 months, approximately 130,000 U.S. troops will return home from Iraq. They'll be replaced by 105,000 soldiers in the largest American troop rotation since World War II. Sergeant Megan Kelly is one soldier who came back early in the rotation. The 25-year-old reservist serving with the 325th Military Intelligence Battalion in Tikrit, also came back engaged to fellow soldiers, Staff Sergeant Kurt Keller, who was also deployed in Iraq. On Point producer Meghna Chakrabarty recently sat down with Megan Kelly and her parents, Beth and Chris, and talked about her 8 long months in Iraq and her return home.
Does anybody need a glass of water?
Howdy.
Hello. Nice to meet you. Really
Dad, nice. Should we take the phone off the hook just in case the phone rings?
And you don't need
we can
water?
Edit it out, right?
Yeah.
What are we talking about?
When you joined up, you were 18?
I was 18 years old.
What year was that?
1996.
And then when did you find out that you were going to Iraq?
In February of 2003.
What'd you think?
You know, I'm 18 years old signing up. You know, young. It's still, I mean, I didn't have a full understanding of the military. And really the thought of me being in a country like that, I wanted to go to a country like that, but at wartime, it, you know, when you're signing up and all that, you don't think it's going to happen, but it did. But you just can't prepare yourself for anything that happens there. You can try and try and do a lot of training and but you're scared. I mean, I was. I mean, maybe not everybody, but I was scared just because of the unknown. You just don't know what you're getting yourself into, and still you start doing the job. And then once you just get so busy, and you're just working all the time, and I don't know. You just get used to
everything.
It.
Everything. Like she would say, I saw a camel today.
You know,
she always, or the beautiful sunsets, with the sunsets.
Yeah.
When you guys found out that she was being deployed to Iraq, like, what was that like?
Well, initially just frightening. It's because you just don't know. I mean, it's that the combat and the way things are conducted over there is just, you know, it's crazy. So you're happy and, you know, proud that you're, you know, patriotic that your daughter's going to go over there. But, you know, the other part of it, you're scared. You know, she was in harm's way. So it was not a good feeling at the time,
yeah.
You know, not a good feeling.
And we didn't expect her, really, to wind up in Iraq. I thought she'd be in Kuwait and behind the scenes and everything mm-hmm. would calm down and then you would get bits and pieces of information and then you would say, where are you? What are you doing? You know, it was, like, shocking. But I never expected her to be running around to Crit and some of the places that she was at.
Yeah, the other frustrating thing, because she was in military intelligence, she couldn't tell us where she was going, what she was doing, timing, goals, objectives, none of that stuff. So it was just very, from that standpoint, it was frustrating. And I would joke, I says, okay, Megan, this is great. Tell him, you know, your father said it's time to come home. Says, that's cool, exciting, wonderful, super glad you're helping, but just tell him when you have to pack your packs and come home. But the service doesn't work that way. That was one of my constant refrains when she would call, and I'd say, because, you know, that's enough, come on.
majority of the time that I was there in the beginning, because I'm an Arabic linguist, so I was a role as an interpreter because we were short on native and contract linguists.
I don't know how many people in your unit spoke Arabic, mm-hmm. but like, did you find that since you were one of those people that the Iraqi people kind of treat you differently, or was there sort of... Because, like, you were the connection there, so I'm wondering, like, yeah. when the Iraqi people found out.
Oh, yeah, when they would know I spoke Arabic, especially if we were, like, out on the streets, you know, just trying to talk to the people, there would be times where they'd just, like, I'd just be crowded with, you know, with just swarms of people, just them having, you know, a complaint or a concern or something that they wanted to get to the military. So it was, sometimes it was very overwhelming, and, once they found out you speak Arabic, they come running.
And she got some marriage proposals.
Oh, yes. Well, sometimes, too, if they were getting a little fresh, I'd say, hey, you have to be careful because my boyfriend, who is also a soldier, is here in Iraq, and he wouldn't like you to treat me like that. So.
You guys came under attack?
Yeah, everywhere. You're always... there. Yeah, someone's under attack.
What was that like?
The first time I heard a mortar go off, and I was like, oh my goodness, what was that? And we were actually, it was so hot, and we had no air conditioning at our house at the time, and we were all sleeping outside. And I said, okay, that's all right. I'm just going to stay inside from now on. I don't care how hot it is. So, yeah.
Did anyone in your unit get injured?
Yeah, we lost two soldiers out of our unit. Wow. Yeah, so that was, it was very difficult. And another thing, too, being in military intelligence, you just would think that we wouldn't be in such harm's way compared to, like, infantry and, you know, field artillery and things like that. But, yeah, but, you know, we were put in a situation, a couple of situations where we had soldiers die.
I mean, can you talk about that?
One of them I was pretty close to in there. I was actually there when he died. So it's kind of a difficult... it's still kind of difficult to talk about, so because you feel guilt through that too, because it's like, you know, why them and not me, and you know, how come I get to come home to my family and they don't.
When you found out that you were coming home,
mm-hmm.
when was that? When did you find out?
September time frame is when we kind of started talking about going home. And
well, we thought she'd be home in September.
Yeah.
But, and then she kept saying, don't get your hopes up, don't get your hopes up.
So,
What was it like for you guys when you finally saw her?
I had to sneak down and see her at Fort Dix. I couldn't wait till she actually came home. So I got to see her in her desert uniform, which I hadn't seen before. It was very exciting. I thought I might be so excited that I'd throw up. But I didn't throw up.
It felt weird, and almost in a way, it didn't feel real. Like, you're getting on a plane, you're going home, you're like, it didn't sink in, you know. Probably until, like, I saw my mom, and I was like, wow, I'm home.
Sergeant Megan Kelly is 25 years old. She's a reservist with the 325th Military Intelligence Battalion. She came home after serving 8 months in Iraq and lives with her parents, Beth and Chris, in Bellingham, Massachusetts. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.